will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding? With my hook for a hand, I'll split you from your groin to your gullet. I came for you.
Welcome to Now Playing's Candyman movie review series.
The urban legend is, if you say his name five times while looking in the mirror, he appears in the reflection and kills you.
Hosted by Arnie.
You like hanging out with this Latin lover because he's dangerous?
Stuart.
He's the monster that's part of this neighborhood.
And Jacob.
You are not content with the stories, so I was obliged to come.
This podcast may contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
These stories are modern oral folklore.
Listener discretion is advised.
Now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me.
Be my victim.
Today we're discussing Candyman 3, Day of the Dead. Starring Tony Todd, Donna DeErico, Nick Corey, Ernie Hudson Jr.
That Jr. is the important part there.
Yeah, I looked up to see if Ernie Hudson was a Jr. from Ghostbusters, but no, this is his kid.
Directed by Turi Meyer. This is the Now Playing co-host who feels like he's been a victim, Arnie.
And Stuart.
Hello, all my little bumblebees. This is Jacob.
Candyman 3, the movie nobody wanted to make except Tony Todd.
Well, it was the height of being a serial killer fan again, right? I mean, 1999, we had had the whole resurgence for several years. Scream had made it cool to be this kind of horror icon again. But they don't go with that. I mean, the obvious thing to do would be to set this movie on a movie set, right? Like Candyman's trying to get popular by making a movie about himself and Virginia Madsen's going to play herself or something like that. You know what I mean? Like you could have had fun with the postmodern reflexiveness that Scream did, but they, for whatever reason, decided that wasn't Candyman's bag.
Well, it was Scream that got Candyman back in the discussion. You know, Candyman 2 hadn't really done that well at the box office, and propaganda films that made it just did not want to do a 3. But after Scream, you know, they were looking at bringing back so much horror. Chucky came back. Michael Myers came back for the first time out of, what, he's been back 4 times now?
Yeah, everyone. I mean, and then, you know, if you aren't good enough for theaters, there is that Leprechaun and Pinhead money on straight to tape, which is what this thing ended up doing, right? It did not come out in a movie theater at all.
No, it was straight to tape. Here's what happened is Tony Todd was in Wishmaster, which was an Artisan production. And Artisan seemed to have affection for horror. And so he approached Artisan and said, hey, would you like to make a Candyman movie? Now, this is the actor doing it. He has no rights to this at all. He's just the actor, but he's going to them and saying, would you like to make Candyman? And they're like, yeah, we'd make a Candyman movie.
That's a step up from Wishmaster for sure.
This movie?
Well, yeah, when you get into specifics, I mean just the IP in general.
He then got them with propaganda films, and it turned out Sony had some rights too. And so they'd started production when Sony's like, wait, we own the character. And they had 30 days to decide if they wanted to hold the rights. But if they held the rights, they'd actually have to make the movie. And so their people were like, no, we don't want to make a Candyman movie. So the all went to Artisan, and they were trying a new strategy for horror where they'd make movies for modest budgets, not cheapo, you know, not filmed in Bulgaria for a nickel.
Hellraiser 6.
Yeah. And they would sell them to television networks for the premiere and then release them to video. So they make more money through the TV sale than they would just a straight direct to video, and probably end up making more because they said they're saving a ton of money because it's the TV network that's doing the ad campaign. They don't have to pay for the ad campaign the way they would for a theatrical release. So Wishmaster 2 and Candyman 3 were the first out of Arterson's new direct-to-TV, then video model.
And when you say direct-to-TV, you mean cable, I assume, because network television was never hip enough to be like, yeah, we want to have R-rated content.
Oh, yeah, maybe to cable, but they're still editing this.
And I'm pretty sure both of them were Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah, let's just call it what it is. Man Thing. Yeah, just the crap that, again, I wouldn't have known this came out. Like, I had no idea how many Candyman movies they made. They only made 3, and this was the reason why they stopped. So who's behind it? The saving grace has been, we've at least had good directors. Bernard Rose on the original, Bill Condon last week, people that went on to have reputable mainstream careers. Who the hell's Turi Meyer?
Arnie, you watch Smallville? Tell us all about this director.
Because
it looks like a lot of TV people involved.
Yeah, it looks like he produces the kind of TV show I never watch, like Vampire Diaries, where it's all like CW pretty people, and they say it's horror, but it's really just about like some kind of LARP, slightly kinky, like fang fantasy.
Well, I mean, watch what you guys say. You're discussing the writer of Leprechaun 2, thank you.
Okay, and chairman of the board, apparently.
Oh, we got Carrot Top bloodlines in here?
They needed Carrot Top, quite frankly. They needed some laughs.
Oh, yeah. Imagine him pulling out his prop case and a prop hook. Just I want 20 minutes of hook puns coming out of this film.
Candyman was, I believe, his last movie. And after that, he did go to direct some television. He did an episode of Buffy, a decent episode at that. Some Angel, some Smallville, a X-Men show called Mutant X that's kind of X-Men. Like, Fox wanted to make an X-Men show and Marvel said, no, you can't. And they said, we're going to do it anyway.
I saw that. So that's not an X-Men film that we're going to have to go back and review. No. Like Generation X.
It's a 3-season syndicated TV show.
That where they just stole X-Men.
Yes.
And they're like, we don't care. We're doing it anyway.
And he's worked in television, I mean, consistently. So he is somebody with a career.
Yeah, on time, under budget. That's what he's good at.
That got his start with Carrot Top and Warwick Davis.
Yeah, I'm less impressed.
Is Warwick Davis in chairman of the board?
No, Leprechaun 2.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Anyway, you warned us last week that this was going to be the handiwork of a Playboy playmate.
I think she'd rather be called a Baywatch babe, but yes.
Yeah, Donna DiArco. I vaguely remember this being a name bandied about in the late 90s. Would work, again, if you go with my concept that, like, they're recasting Candyman 2 and Virginia Madsen is mad that this bimbo is taking her part and then she gets killed in the postmodern style. Like, that would be a fun joke on Hollywood and the way it treats actresses over 30. But if you mean this to be serious and, like, she's the daughter of the girl last week, what year is it? What genre is this? This seems like a really bad calculation.
I love Wikipedia, absolutely love it, because the plot summary there, whoever wrote it, is really into the Candyman EU or something, because it starts off by going, in 2020, 25 years after the event, I'm like, wait a second.
This movie is taking place right now?
And she's not wearing a mask.
Irresponsible, everyone at this art gallery.
I'm done. Done with the film.
You don't need Candyman to kill you. The COVID got you.
COVID-19, COVID-19, COVID-19.
I think that's how the Chinese created it, yeah.
Just said it 5 times into a mirror. But yeah, they're really like, and they discuss how Candyman killed Caroline's uncle, and I'm like, her uncle? Oh yeah, I guess there was Ethan, wasn't there? But this person wrote the plot summary of Candyman 3 like there's actually continuity that's referenced in this film. Because, yes, in this movie, there's no commentary. Nobody did jack or shit for this. I dug up a 1999 issue of Fangoria magazine I happen to have.
Okay, well, thanks for digging deep.
And I was able to read some of the stuff in that article, which gave me how Tony Todd brought it about. And the article states that Donna DiArico here is supposed to be playing a 24-year-old, and she was 4 when we last saw her at the end of the last movie, which was 5 years after the main plot of the last movie. So that would actually put us like 29 years after the second movie, right?
So like 4 years from now, 2024.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, you know, how can we judge the future? Yes, this could be very accurate.
But I don't see cell phones.
We don't know what's going to happen with this virus. We may ditch those. Who knows?
I don't see the Apple logo everywhere. I don't, you know, I still see CRT monitors. Unfortunately, LAPD police racism is something that's never going to go out of fashion, I see, but...
Probably not. But again, if you were going to think of all the ways that you could promote yourself, Candyman, not social media, like he's no Facebook, no Insta page, nothing like that.
Oh, come on. He'd be on TikTok.
Yeah, right. I'm waiting for him to learn about social media and likes, because I really feel like this guy will dig it. But instead, no, he's got to patrol art galleries in L.A. with that. Let's get into this plot, Arnie.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about the continuity here. Yeah, give us a plot, Arnie.
Well, the story follows Caroline McKeever. And if you don't remember her, she was the little girl at the very end of Candyman 2, who I believe, and the Fangoria article states, is Candyman's great-great-great-granddaughter.
Yeah, they say that in the movie, three greats.
No, this movie says two greats. I watched this movie twice for this review.
I didn't read Fangoria. I don't know where I got the three greats from then.
I don't see anything great in this movie, but continue.
At least once they only say great-great. But it's supposed to be the great-great-great-granddaughter. She's all grown up, 24 years old, and played by Donna DiArco, living in Los Angeles. I have no idea what she does for a job, but she's the owner of the collected paintings of her ancestor, Daniel Robitaille, aka the Candyman. She's been having nightmares about her ghostly, murderous ancestor, but during an exhibition of the Candyman's art, Caroline is forced to prove she doesn't believe the urban legend about her ancestor's ghost, so she says Candyman five times in a mirror. This, of course, brings back the Candyman, played again by Tony Todd. He wants Caroline to choose to let him kill her. That way the Candyman's entire extended family will be together in the afterlife.
Because we'll all know if Donna DiArco is wiped from the earth.
And I think he also wants to fuck her.
Yeah, there's a real incest storyline going on here.
Yeah, Tony Todd's going to get a bedroom scene.
To try and coerce Caroline into making that decision, Candyman starts to kill her friends, and Caroline is the chief suspect in the murders. In fact, Police Detective Samuel Kraft is so convinced of her guilt, he doesn't want to arrest her, he wants to kill her. Candyman kidnaps David, a man Caroline had been flirting with, played by Nick Corey. Caroline pursues Candyman to save David. There, she confronts Candyman, and rather than go with him, she takes a hook and destroys a giant painting of Candyman's human form. As the painting is shredded, Candyman bursts into flames. David is saved, but Detective Kraft, having lost his job for misconduct, tries to kill Caroline with a hook. Kraft is shot by another cop, and all the hook murders are pinned on Kraft.
Another cop, Ernie Hudson Jr.
Who aren't you gonna call?
So is this also a sequel to The Crow, where Ernie Hudson was the cop? I mean, we could really get an EU going here. But with the death of Kraft, the myth of the Candyman is dispelled, forever leaving the ghost in movie villain purgatory, as credits roll. And as it starts, we start in, not my dream, but Donna DiArco's dream, and I asked my wife, I'm like, do all women wear just a halter top and panties into their dreams? She says they don't, so I'm going to have to go with that.
This does feel like one of those videos you would like find in the adult section of your video store. It's like, you know, like the gauzy photography and the flowing white curtains and all of that. Like, it doesn't feel like the opening to a horror movie. It definitely feels like Playboy centerfold time.
Yeah, there's a bathtub laying there. Is she going to get in there?
I'm surprised that she doesn't go topless in this movie. We have three women who go topless in it, but Donna DiArco, she's 4 years past her playmate days. She'll tease, but not show.
Yeah, I will say just off the bat, since we're on the subject, like all the nudity in this installment does feel very exploitive. Like I think we said in that first film, you get some side boob and it's the most unsexy side boob as that actress is like crying and heaving there. Here, it's too titillate.
Yet it fails on every level to do that. We'll talk about it when we get there.
I learned something about sex. I had no idea you could do that with a honeycomb, but you're right. We got to see.
See, that's what I was thinking. Oh, God. I've had a lot of weird fantasies, but never a honeycomb.
That's just a lot of cleanup afterwards.
It very is. Sticky. Potential stings. Just all bad. I just can't.
The honey bear is one thing, but the honeycomb is something totally new. Let's just start with script fundamentals. Who is Caroline McKeever and what does she want?
Yeah, agreed. All I know is she wants to go off to the art gallery and I want to follow her roommate. She's got this cool roommate who's trying to audition for a horror movie and I'm like, yes, let's go to the set of a horror movie. It's Hollywood. We're in LA. The art scene is there, but it's just not exciting to explore. So like, I don't know why they made the decision. I guess because he's a painter, right? They're married to that as a backstory for Daniel Robitaille. Because he's a painter, they feel like they need to go down this very dull path of, we have to make his paintings exciting to the world in order to sell Candyman as a killer again.
No, Stuart, we don't have to do that because these paintings have never been established. We never knew that there were just enough paintings for a gallery to fill. If I was a super racist dude and I killed this guy because he impregnated my daughter, I don't know, I'd probably burn the paintings too. They probably wouldn't be sitting around.
And did Galileo or Van Gogh ever decide, you know what I want to do? A 12-foot self-portrait full body.
Yeah, Daniel Robitaille is a little full of himself. That is a huge portrait painting he did. And I gotta say, these prop paintings, these look awful. Like, they ran it under a Photoshop filter and printed it out on some canvas. It doesn't even look like an oil painting.
Not to mention the idea that Donna D'Errico is going to no good art. Doesn't want to take off her clothes. You're right, this must be the year, like, 3034 or something. Like, we're in, like, in some way distant science fiction, because I don't understand anything about this setup. It seems wrong. It seems like this is not the way that you would want to start a part three.
And she doesn't work at the gallery, right? Like, it's her art, I guess. After the last movie, maybe her mother decided to collect all these works or something, because we knew they never had them before, because Caroline's grandmother would deny any relation to Robitaille, so she wouldn't keep these around.
Yeah, here's the thing, Arnie. Unless you're like a famous painter and a gallery's going to come to you, hey, we want to do an exhibit. Like, this happens in LA a lot. Yeah, I'm going to rent out a gallery and throw, you know, have it open for a few weeks and maybe sell a painting or two so I'll come out even. Like, I don't know where she's getting the money. I'm not even sure where this is taking place in LA, but I guess the rent on this gallery is real low.
Oh, it's East LA.
But it's Miguel's gallery. She's the one who keeps saying, I'll take these paintings right away from you. And Miguel's the one like, we need to have a big opening. So she doesn't own the gallery. I don't even think she works at the gallery. Maybe she makes a living going town to town and renting out the paintings?
Yeah, no, I take it to mean that she is not in it for the money. She wants to restore the name of her great-great-great-great-great-great-whatever grandfather. And the way to do that is to host an art gallery exhibition in East LA.
Yeah, East LA?
Yeah, we get a few shots of like Cesar Chavez Avenue. And for some reason, they have this sort of creepy moment where she's given a sugar skull. And the title makes me think, oh, this is happening Halloween, right? And then the day after, the Day of the Dead, this is going to have a Latino flavor, which was kind of in vogue. At this point, this was the era of J-Lo and Ricky Martin, and there were a lot of Latin musicians and actors getting their due in the late 90s. So if they want to go in that direction, that seems like that's a new angle that could bear fruit.
Yeah, they're going to use that angle, the exact opposite of what the second film did with New Orleans, where that was like over-the-top accents and Mardi Gras sex going on all over the place. Like, that was all about Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Like, this is about Day of the Dead in East LA. It doesn't feel like it.
It really doesn't. I don't think they could really afford a parade to put the action scenes in. I think the Day of the Dead is the fact that this has the highest body count of any of them, but I'll be blunt. I had to watch this film twice to really pay attention / soak it all in. Because I watched it yesterday, and the day we're recording, I sat down to write the plot summary and was like, so much of it was vague to me. I watched this a second time, making it four full times I've watched this. I watched it when it was new on video, I watched it when we did Hellraiser, and twice now. So I've sat through this four times. The fact that this is during the Mexican Day of the Dead is referenced, but inconsequential.
Right. It seems like that's not the angle you want to go. Again, I would just argue you have this roommate who is going to be on a horror movie set, and it's trendy in this time to talk about movies within movies. it would have just been so easy to go in that direction. It would have just been so right for Candyman to try and promote his legend in a horror movie. The art gallery just feels dead on arrival. They try to work a little postmodernism in here. They have these goth people that are sipping the wine, eating the cheese, looking at the paintings, and quoting from the first movie. They're, you know, giggling, what's blood for if not for shedding, and sweets for the sweets. And you can tell that they really get off on the ghost story of Daniel Robitaille.
Oh, yeah, they're going to be a big, scary gang by the end of this film. Didn't you see that coming?
I did not.
And it is during this that where we see Robitaille get off, because it's during the exhibition. Miguel tells the whole story, and we've got some serious retconning going on now.
Yes, again, continuity. There is none. It's gone from day to night now.
Which I like. Again, I want to advocate that's how urban legends survive. A game of telephone. The story is never the same when you get to the end as when it starts at the beginning. So I love the fact that in East L.A., Candyman, I mean, he might even be played by Cheech or Chong. You know what I mean? You go with
Stuart,
that.
You need to drop this, because I agree with you. That would be cool if that's what these movies were about. They are not about that.
Yeah, this is not the urban legend series. I'd be happy to do it if you want to, and then we can talk urban legends all you like. But Candyman left that behind as a passing idea in the first film that somebody was researching, and then it never came up again. But here, my head's about to explode trying to figure out the pieces of how a slave created a shoe machine, becoming rich.
Educated his son.
Then the son apparently was killed in Chicago, where his ashes were scattered over Cabrini.
Here's the crazy thing. I don't think they've said this before. They said it in this one. It was a Confederate general who hired him to paint a picture of his... And look, maybe I know there's this revisionist history, and maybe he was just for state rights. Like, slavery just happened to be the state right issue they were fighting over. Maybe he didn't have a pony in that horse. He just was super for state rights, but I don't think a Confederate general is hiring a black man to paint his daughter or even his house, probably.
And did the Confederate general move up north to Chicago?
Yeah, it's kind of how the Nazis went to South America after the war.
But again, we need to understand that the story mutates, and it's fine. If this story now wants to embrace the Civil War, strange, but okay, we can go with that. The fact that he's strung up on a cross and dies the fifth time that they're chanting the word Candyman, you can see them trying much harder now to work in all the elements we know about, like, you know, saying the name five times in a mirror into this backstory. They're really trying to hone it so that it feels cohesive.
And I did pick up, like, he is chained to a tree or something. Like, are they going for a Jesus metaphor? Because, again, Candyman is never good. I'm always rooting for him, but he always ends up being an asshole and just killing everyone. I'm like, I get that Clive Barker likes to play with that imagery. I'm guessing he probably didn't even know this was being... he got a check, probably, so that's how he knew this was being made. But I don't think... Yeah, it's a weird detail to have him tied to this tree where it does look like he's being crucified.
But it's disappointing when even some of the worst Friday the 13th sequels do a better job than Candyman 3 of explaining how the baddie exists again. Because we were told... You said, Stuart, we're finding out all these elements of his lore, and they said Candyman five times while he died, but we found out in the last one, the biggest element of his lore is the mirror, and we found out it was because he was looking into Caroline's mirror when he died, and the mirror was smashed. Candyman was defeated forever.
Again, continuity is not my complaint. In fact, it's actually a strength of this movie that it mutates as we go to a new location. I'm happy that we're not still in New Orleans or back in Cabrini. I think it's right to go to a new place. I guess I would just advocate, if we're going to East LA, maybe we need to bring in some Latino street urban legends. Maybe it even could be a gang war. Like, Candyman's got to compete with La Llorona.
Yeah, the one gang in this film is a bunch of white goths.
Yeah, agreed. I'm thinking about all the ways that they could use the raw materials here at the beginning, which feel strangely put together, to good effect. How do we make this work? And yeah, if he's coming to a neighborhood and trying to make a name for himself in East LA, yeah, I would imagine it's going to be tough to create a fan base to get that gang going. He's going to need to do something here. And Miguel, the gallery owner's idea is, let's have some actor with a hook smash through the mirror.
Some actor This is...
Carrot Top? Is this where he shows up?
It should have been.
This is Nick Corey.
Okay, what weird thing that you like was he in?
A Nightmare on Elm Street, where he played pretty much the same exact role, where he is blamed for the murder of Tina and has to go on the run from the cops.
Oh, okay, that's a pretty big role in that film.
I'm confused. This is not Sisu Garcia?
Well, that's his real name. But he was still being billed as Nick Corey at this point, because in 1984, with Nightmare on Elm Street, they weren't looking for Hispanics. And so he went with Nick Corey because he can play white, and did in many times. In this movie, at the end, he's credited as Nick Corey, and then in parentheses, Sue Garcia.
The character's name is David De La Paz, and I think he is of this neighborhood. I think they're trying to say that his Latino culture is important. I mean, later his grandma is going to do some kind of Santeria ritual. So I think, again, it's an opportunity. I see this as a way of enriching the myth of Candyman by bringing in all of this East LA Latino culture stuff.
What it took me the second viewing to really hit home is that this movie is going to try to tell us that the relationship or the flirtation between Caroline and David is as controversial as a 19th century relationship between Candyman and a white woman.
I mean, Jim Crow America, yes, that's still going to be controversial. 1999 or 2034, whenever this movie's taking place. I mean, yeah, there is a racist cop, but he's the one making that judgment. I never felt like this was a controversial pairing between a white girl and a Hispanic guy.
I didn't even understand the first time I watched it that that's why the cop was pissed. I mean, that is how little I think as a Hispanic guy married to a white woman. I don't even think about that. I'm like, what is this cop's problem? And in the second viewing, I'm like, oh shit. He's racist against Hispanics and he thinks she's a race traitor. I didn't get that the first time.
And here's the thing. This is the one thing I think they got right in this film, and it's probably because it's LA people who work in TV and they just know the culture out here. Kraft, this racist cop, they say that he is from Simi Valley, which totally makes sense. One, Simi Valley is where the Rodney King trial took place, where all these cops were found not guilty.
Okay. That is subtext, for sure. They're definitely doing something there.
Yeah, and it's just a community. A lot of the LAPD actually live there, even though it's not in LA County. A lot of them live in Simi Valley. So I'm like, ah, there's the one detail they got right. If you're familiar, yeah, I think with what happened with Rodney King out here, that is an indicator for who Kraft is.
Okay, but just to walk it back, because I actually, you lost me a little bit here. The racist cop is showing up largely because he's leaning in on Miguel, the gallery owner, and he makes comments about you people and all of this stuff. And so he's mad at Miguel for having a gallery and for having a blonde woman that he's taking home. You're saying that he's also going to be mad at Donna D'Errico for having a black great-great-great-great-great-grandfather?
No, for being into David De La Paz.
Oh, okay. All right, maybe.
No, he hits on her and says, you know, after the gallery owner's dead, we gave him a hard time, but we really liked him. And then he brings roses to her. And when he's going to give her the roses, he sees her with David. And then he calls David ethnic slurs and says stuff to her.
Oh, I mean, we should just say, remind people, this is called Candyman. And Candyman shows up about 20 minutes in. And this is where you know you can turn it off. She's out at the subway station, and we hear the bees.
What subway station is this? This looks like no subway station in LA, New York, or wherever they have subways.
It's, yeah, clearly somebody's studio that they've rigged up something. It's not, I've ridden and enjoyed the LA subway, but
they don't look like that, though.
No, they don't. But yes, Candyman don't look like this either. When he comes riding in on his bees, they just don't have the money, right? Cancel this. It's over. Like, if he can't float in and look cool the way that he's floated in previous movies, don't make this movie. Don't hurt his legacy. His legacy is everything. And when you take it away and make him strung up there by video toaster effects, It's killing everything. It's killing me. My soul is being torn apart.
Yeah, I put a question mark because I didn't even... I'm like, is that bees carrying Candyman? Is that what they're trying to tell us? Like, I wasn't even sure it looked so bad.
I didn't know. They kept cutting to bees. I thought they were just inferring bees.
They're all around Candyman and he's floating.
And what does he want? The only way this movie's going to work. I'm like, all right, this is bad. I don't like anything about this. I don't like any of the actors. Maybe the roommate, but for the most part, everything, every choice feels wrong, but they can fix it. I can hang on this because I like Tony Todd. And if they give Tony Todd room to, like, finally own this series in the way that Robert Englund kind of took over Nightmare on Elm Street in that third movie, okay, let him do it. But, like, I think this is just another, like... I'm going to let you figure out that you need to die, and I'm going to just kind of, like, hang out in the background while you're bumbling around. Like, I don't feel like he has a really clear idea about what he needs from his great-great-great-great-granddaughter or from life.
Yeah, Artie, you say Tony Todd wanted this movie to happen. Is that because he doesn't have to do much in these films? Well, he'll be in, like, 20 minutes of footage when you add it all together, or maybe 8, like you said with that first one, and he gets the same paycheck. Maybe that's why he wanted the third one. Very little work needed from him.
Yeah, he wanted the movie, and his work talking to the studios got him a co-producer credit, but then I don't think he knew what to do with the movie. I don't think he had any creative input. He just wanted to work again and be a horror icon again and thought, you know, Freddy got 7 films. I should at least get 3 or 4. And yet what we have here is 2 retold, but yet kind of like 1 in a little bit of ways. But this feels like we're rewatching part 2, and that's not the one to remake.
That's exactly it. It's like he can go anywhere and do anything. Your star is Candyman. You didn't make Midnight Meat Train. You didn't get Virginia Madsen back. Forget the white women. Like, it's not their story. Tell more with Tony Todd. He's a good actor. He's a tall, imposing presence. He can do sexy. He can do scary. He can be funny. You can do it, but you got to use him. Having him float in on bees and be a dream sequence and disappear for 40 more minutes is just like saying, we didn't make a Candyman movie. We made some other lame movie in East LA and then brought Tony Todd in for 5 minutes.
I mean, do we know that wasn't the case?
No, we don't.
We do get a lot more kills in this one, though, because after he does appear in the subway, he is going to go and kill Miguel. And Miguel has a girlfriend that I didn't know about. We are introduced to her for the first time when, yes, she's doing things with honeycombs that should never be done.
Rubbing? I guess in theory, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, Sex on the Beach, that sounds like fun. And then you get sand all up in every crack and you're like, no.
Yeah, anything involving food, it gets messy.
Right, yeah. These are the things that movies tell you are really erotic, and then you try them and you go, never again with the honeycomb.
You got to do laundry right afterwards, yeah.
And if you get sugar in a woman's certain part, yeast infections are common. I mean, oof.
But they're desperately trying to make it sexy. That is the one thing I'm getting out of all of these scenes, is that they definitely feel like if we have nothing else, we're going to be trashy and B-movie and sex it up.
Yeah, you're saying sexy. This is exploitive nudity.
But you know what? That's a way to go with it. I mean, I honestly think...
It is. That's what's going to get people to rent it at Blockbuster when those existed.
Right. I feel like if you just make it trashy and titillating, that's enough. Again, I'm just trying to keep the floor from falling out from underneath. I know it's not going to be as good as we got. I just don't want to fall any further. It's really important not to, like, go to the depths of a Hellraiser 7. We just can't do that. And this movie has been tottering on that edge all throughout the beginning here.
I understand that they're going with rote slasher cliches and things, and they're wanting to just have these kills. One thing that kind of hurts Candyman is Jason, he has a machete, but he'd always mix it up. He'd pick up a harpoon gun, or he'd squeeze somebody's head, or he'd pick them up in a sleeping bag and bash them against a tree. Candyman has a hook. He is going to impale so many people on that hook and stick it through them like four times in this movie.
There is the saying, groin to gullet. Like that, I feel like that's supposed to be his MO. I feel like we get the groin off camera and that hook never gets up to the gullet. It's very disappointing.
Right, and I always felt like that read a little bit anyway as a sexual come on as well. I mean, like hooking you, like I felt like he was getting something out of it and it was more than just bloodlust.
I never got that necessarily, but he is supposed to be a sexier killer. I mean, it was love that he died for, but to mix it up, this nameless, topless, honey-covered woman will die of bee stings, much like Candyman himself, because she was smeared with honey. She is going to die covered in bees.
I feel like that unless you have an allergy, that takes a lot of bee stings.
Miguel, meanwhile, gets killed by the hook. And I think the hook's important because it's the same hook that David had earlier for the stunt in the gallery. I think. He's worried about that anyway. He's thinking fingerprints. He's thinking if that murder weapon turns up, I'm going to go to jail. This will be the impetus for him to come to Donna D'Arco and have the middle of this movie. They're running around, I think, looking for a hook. Maybe.
I thought they were looking for Candyman to prove it wasn't him. I don't know that they knew it was the same hook. I mean, just a hook murder, I think that would be enough. I mean...
Well, if for some reason you're looking for Ernie Hudson Jr., this is one of his two scenes. Like, after this murder, him and another cop come in, and then they're immediately, like, kicked out of the scene. These two racist cops, Kraft and Sacco, they're like, nope, we have jurisdiction. I was shocked. I'm like, that's got to be Ernie Hudson Jr. Oh, there he goes. He's in this about as much as Candyman.
Yeah, and we have all these characters milling about, and yet I don't feel like they're being set up like bowling pins to be knocked down. It doesn't feel like, oh, I now know, plugging in a slasher movie formula, how this is going to go. It's really confusing to me. Candyman has a hook, but the story has no hooks. I feel like people wander in search of what they're supposed to be doing. Where's my motivation is like what she's really looking for. And I don't know what to tell her. Like, I have no idea why you are riding around on the back of his motorcycle going to talk to some crime lord in a bar. Nino or Tino or something?
Yeah, I think it's Tino and...
Like Latino? I mean, clever, huh? But yeah, it's just so she can end up in like a bar bathroom having Candyman, again, not kill her. He refuses to put her life in peril. He's just like, oh, you're going to figure out you're going to want me someday. He's like just a stalker. He's just like this sad nerd that like won't leave her alone.
But isn't that what he did to Helen in the first movie?
Yeah, but Helen had something that she was investigating. As I guess the difference is Helen had him to unmask a series of urban legend killings as the work of a drug dealer. And here, I mean, she knows it's Candyman because she saw him in the subway. She's not trying to believe that he isn't real. So I feel like for lots of reasons, it's not the same thing as the first movie.
No, it's like the second movie where, again, the Annie there knew he was real, but also like the first movie in that he's saying, be my victim, like he did to Helen, and saying, you must make the choice. I'll just kill everybody around you, and people will suspect you or David or both of murder, but you must choose to be his victim. It feels like they're trying to make the first film without fully understanding what the first film was offering. They're saying the lines, they're doing some of the acts. It even goes against what we saw last time because Candyman showed up for Annie and was like, I won't kill you because you are carrying a baby and that carries on my bloodline. So,
but we're told, I think we'll see a flashback. You know, we had that dream sequence with the bathtub that Annie did finally say his name and died because of it.
Yes. It's not the same actress from the second movie.
No, it's very distracting.
Yeah. But she, at some point in raising her daughter, got the hook across the neck. But the daughter always believed that her mother was mentally imbalanced and suicidal. It's been a revelation, I would think, even almost a comfort to realize, oh, there really is a phantom killer in our family tree. And my mom wasn't suicidal. She was just a victim.
And Candyman keeps bringing out Annie, the mother. I would think you could play this more for Shining-like horror, because God knows, if I saw my mother, my dead mother, walking at me fully naked with her blood pouring out of her neck, there's 18 kinds of horror going on in that, but they really just play up the blood and nothing else.
Yeah, they're saying one family, one destiny, one blood. Like, is this Candyman trying to raise his own family in his weird, twisted way? Again, I would love some kind of theme that plays out in this film. Instead, we just get a lot of lines that are said.
Yeah, I don't want to go down the family. It didn't help Halloween to find out that Laurie and Michael were brother and sister. Like,
but we already know these are all related.
Yeah, we don't. I don't even think that's interesting. What was interesting about the character was that he lived because people spoke of him. And the more power you give his legacy, the more he can get you. I mean, that to me is the hook. That's the thing I want to see.
Stuart, you may be the only one that finds that interesting because they don't want to do that in the sequels.
Yeah, it's painful that they won't. But I mean, again, here we are in East LA, culturally rich. Wouldn't it be cool if we did have like El Diablo? We're told there's this shed where this little girl got murdered. Candyman didn't do that murder. What if we had another Phantom? What if we had another killer? What if there was somebody else stalking these streets and Candyman had, again, if it's about gang war, let's do that with slasher villains.
I think where the first film really excelled was not necessarily the urban legend, but remember, the story was originally titled The Forbidden, and we spent half that movie without Candyman. But the fear was Cabrini Green and going into a dangerous place and having somebody explore a culture and a place that they weren't supposed to be in. I don't feel like Caroline here is out of her element in East LA at all.
Yeah, she's a very, very white girl in a very, very Hispanic part of Los Angeles. They're not playing up, right or wrong, any of those fears that people have about, you know, these ethnic neighborhoods.
Again, because it doesn't even really feel like that. It feels like they're on Sesame Street. It feels like you're on a cheap set. I mean, every now and then you'd see the real street, but it just doesn't feel... We knew we were in New Orleans, we knew we were in Cabrini, and here they can't exploit the neighborhood the way that they should. It's too bad.
Yeah, this feels like some street that was closed down and they could just film there.
And I wish Donna DeErico was as good an actress as Maria on Sesame Street.
Yeah, or the actresses we've had previously. You really do need somebody.
I'd take an Annie at this point.
Yeah, of somebody else. It's very... And you never want to feel this way. I can't even make fun of her. I just pity her. I just pity this actress trying to get through this. I'm like, you are so wrong.
Yeah, there's a scene early on, like after she has this dream, she's like sketching Candyman or something. And I don't know, she's doing some lip quivering thing. It's so bizarre. I'm like, is this how they taught you to act frightened on Baywatch?
Yeah, you have a Playboy playmate and all she's going to do is whimper in bathtubs? Who's turned on by this?
And she screams a lot. And the other two women, Annie and Helen, weren't screamers. And it feels like Donna DeErico, you'd hire her to be in a Friday the 13th or something, because a lot of times those auditions were just, how good can you shriek? But here, you know, Candyman is supposed to be like Dracula in a lot of ways, and you're in his thrall. He kind of hypnotizes you. You kind of want to go to him the way he's saying, you know, choose to be my victim. And here, she is just screaming and screaming, and there's all these false scares. I thought of you, Jacob, because you complained so much about the fake jump scares.
Oh, there's so many in this film.
So many. And most of them are her screaming and then people racing in to see if she's okay. And she's like, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah, the terrible, terrible middle of this movie where you just, it does feel like a lot of wandering. She ends up going to David's grandmother's place to get some kind of egg rubbing ritual done to her. It's kind of gross when the bee comes out. I will say that that was effectively icky. When we actually see the egg hatch of a bee.
Yeah, and just the blood in the egg to me was kind of gross. Of course, abuela is Spanish for grandmother, and I think her name's abuela.
Like I said, Tino is the big Latino in the neighborhood. I mean, it's very creative here.
I can't even be offended. It's just lazy. I mean, going there sort of reminded me of The Matrix and going to see the Oracle.
No, I mean, again, it's a way of looking at superstition in a different culture that has been a strength of this series. I want more of this, but it's just like a throwaway scene.
Yeah, this is where, though, they'll plant the idea of how to defeat Candyman this time. It wasn't the mirror. Now, evil can't exist without good. So I'm like, okay, what's the good that's going to have to cease for Candyman? Is it Caroline? Is she going to have to kill herself like she thought her mom did?
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I'm not making a connection that there is another kind of mirror device here. It feels aimless. Again, she ends up like taking this guy home. This guy that was looking for the murderer is like now using it as an opportunity to mack on her and get her into the bedroom so that he can tag out, and suddenly Tony Todd is under the sheets with her.
That was creepy as hell. And that's when I realized there was going to be some incest going on, is when David goes down and she's fully clothed, it appears. I don't know exactly what he's doing to bring her so much joy. She's still got her shirt on, at least. And then the next thing I know, Candyman's putting his fingers in her mouth. And I'm like, wait a sec, this is your great-great-great-granddaughter. That's not right.
Yeah, and then suddenly, okay, like this is someone she met a few hours ago. He's going to dangle this guy on a hook, literally, and be like, if you want him to live, you're going to have to die. I mean, am I callous for saying, okay, I'm going to live? You know, like, not good enough. Like, I don't care about David enough to be, like, sacrificing myself at this point in our relationship.
What if it's, though, because she's the one who called Candyman? Nobody else has said Candyman. Everybody who's dying is dying because she called him in. So there is that level of guilt.
No, no, no. Tamara said Candyman at the beginning of the film. That's why we see the bees in the LA River, and she's going to die later.
Yeah, we're actually right here, right after this sex scene, the character Caroline is going to wake up and David is gone and her roommate is back from the shoot. And again, I liked her. I actually feel like you could have used her better. She's got a good scream, but yeah, they just got her. And then Caroline's going to get blamed for the murder. I feel like that's a note that they shouldn't need to play again. I mean, they're trying to recreate the idea of beheading the dog and missing baby here with the roommate.
Yeah, it just doesn't play nearly as well. Everything they're doing here feels like a cheap direct-to-video imitation, and that's exactly what it is. So congrats for hitting par.
Not only that, but isn't it Halloween? Because, like, the next day is going to be the Day of the Dead. Like, shouldn't somebody be trick-or-treating or dressing up or having a party or at least setting out a jack-o'-lantern? Or, like, where is your love for the iconography of place and season? Even that would get me through what's generic about this movie if it just had some flavor to it, but it is just so antiseptic.
Again, Turi Meyer is the writer-director of this.
Chairman of the board.
Leprechaun 2.
I give Carrot Top more props. I mean, he needs props, but I think it would be more fun to have him. Like, he would be fun to show up, and it's something.
Was he Buff Carrot Top yet at this point? Because I want Buff Carrot Top versus Candyman.
Again, you could pit him against Tony Todd. Who wouldn't want to see that? Pop some popcorn. I'm down. I mean, I just feel like if this is candy, sweets for the sweets, this stuff is not bitter. It's not sweet. It's flavorless. I am just can't believe it's just like eating 5 vats of like aspic. Like, there's just no flavor to this goo.
The only character that has really any interest to me is this racist cop Kraft, who punches Caroline hard in the face to the point that his partner Sacco is pulling him off. And so you think, oh, Sacco's the good cop, Kraft is the bad cop. And then you get in the car and Sacco starts laughing at Caroline too. It's like, okay, it's bad cop, worse cop. And then Candyman kills the cop.
Yeah, just like we saw with Helen. And he's going to give her the keys to the handcuff. So again, it looks like she's responsible.
Wouldn't it just be cleaner if Ernie Hudson Jr. was partnered with the racist? You had the racist cop and then the good cop. Like, I guess this other Sacco's here because, yeah, it's been a while since anyone died. And so we just need to have a victim here in the rearview mirror of the car. Out comes Candyman.
And there's a line later on. Ernie Hudson Jr. has a female partner. So it's like you've got the two racist old man white cops, and then you've got the black guy and the woman partnered together. But the woman has the worst line of the entire movie.
I think I know what it is, but go ahead.
Somehow she breaks out of handcuffs and kills a cop twice her size. Gives a whole new meaning to PMS.
Yes. Yes. I couldn't believe they took it there, really. Like, that's, yeah, like she's on the rack. That's really where they're going to go with this.
It's like that joke was left over from Chairman of the Board.
Chairman of the Board, I'm sure, has smarter PMS jokes in it.
And I sure am bored. I mean, it is. It's just disappointing. Let's just kind of cut through this. Caroline will wander some more, but eventually she's going to find out that, yes, she needs to recover the paintings, which off-screen were stolen. Okay, that's news, but they were stolen.
Stuart, if they weren't stolen, this movie would only be 45 minutes long.
Yeah, Tino knows some guy that knows somebody that's going to take her back to this warehouse where a girl was killed by some other phantom than Candyman. And we get the scene of this Candyman congregation conjuring him.
Which could have been decent at this point. I mean, it was kind of a thing around this time, the whole goth thing. Remember they had the Dracula worshippers in Blade 3 also?
But we're not trying to recreate that. But yes, I do think the idea that Candyman, again, has fans, that people worship him in telling his dirty deeds, that some people would get off on it. You do need characters that enjoy hearing the ghost story. I think that was a right instinct.
Yeah, it feels like this should have been a bigger part. Look, if they're just going to steal stuff from the other films, then steal the gang members pretending to be Candyman and have them play a bigger role in this film.
Like, yes.
Again, it's all of a sudden there's a congregation of Candyman worshippers. Who saw that coming? Just like Ernie Hudson Jr. showing up at the very end. Like, you forgot about him. You forgot about these people at the gallery. All of a sudden they're there again because we got to get some kind of climax going.
Yeah, Caroline has moved to L.A. from New Orleans to become an actress or something like that, and she's in a crime-ridden neighborhood, and this is the gang that's worshiping Candyman. Like, you don't need paintings, you don't need all of this foo-fara, you can just literally just make it about this, because it's really your best asset.
And the gang is really, it's disappointing to me, because I like the idea of the Candyman worshippers, and it's kind of what he wants, right? He wants people to keep speaking his name in shadow and keep being afraid of him. So this gang would be right up his alley, I would think, but they are worshiping him and yet have never tried the Candyman challenge. They've never said it five times in a mirror until they have Caroline there. And then it's a lose-lose, isn't it? Because if you say it five times in a mirror and he shows up, you're dead. If you say it five times in a mirror and he doesn't show up, you're just a douche. So what's the end game?
Yeah, and by this point, anyone that has watched Candyman has probably done the thing in the mirror and gone, okay, that was stupid. You know, like, yeah, I feel like part of the reason why you can't get that excited about it is that he doesn't come on command. It doesn't seem to work that often. So, yeah, there needed to be a reason why he could be conjured now. Again, they have something here. They have something here to the idea that in a gang-ridden LA neighborhood full of superstition, the descendant of Daniel Robitaille could find a way to bring Candyman out and back into being an urban legend. There is a story there to be told, but I can honestly say that nothing that I've seen leading up to this climax has been what I've wanted.
And the painting, I don't know if the gang stole all the paintings or just the giant self-portrait of Robitaille, but Candyman steals the stolen painting and takes it to wherever he's keeping David?
I mean, yes. We can continue to sling this hash, or I could just take my hook out and say not recommend. I mean, I'm kind of done with this movie. I don't know why anything has been happening, and I certainly don't care whether Caroline lives or dies. I wanted Tony to have a moment. Has he had a good moment? Has there been a good kill? Has there been something where you wanted to applaud Candyman for his ability to find mirth, humor, or get a good victim?
Tony Todd delivers great dialogue as Candyman. It's kind of like, it's very much like Doug Bradley as Pinhead, where even in the worst Hellraiser films, you give him some lines about pleasure and flesh and hell, and he makes it sound cool. Tony Todd here with Be My Victim and all of the stuff, I will be given what was taken from me, all of that. He delivers every line really well.
But too many lines, though. Again, he's all talk and no action. I mean, that's the frustration. Yeah, he's got reams and reams of Doug Bradley throwaway monologues, and that's not enough. Like, he should be his own man at this point. Third movie in, it should be on him. He should be the focus. And in the end, we get some stupid climax where a blonde is trying to climb up a hill of garbage to burn a painting.
Those are skulls. Come on. It's scary. They're skeletons.
And she doesn't burn it. She slashes it, which causes him to burn somehow.
Yeah, makes sense.
So you're right. So much better. Anyway. And so then, yes, the racist cop, which, yeah, maybe you want to make some kind of social statement about police or all, but, like, this has gotten really lost in all of that. Like, the racist cop comes, he had the hook, but he didn't turn it in for evidence, and because he beat on Ernie Hudson earlier, he's acting alone, he doesn't have a shield anymore, and it means Ernie can gun him down and pin all the murders on him.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. It's all Kraft's doing. All these murderers, he was being Candyman the whole time.
Well, he stands there and for no apparent reason goes, I am the Candyman. So, of course, Ernie Hudson Jr. is going to think he did all the killings.
Well, Ernie Hudson Jr. is just about as cop as Kraft, yes. Then. Like, do some investigative work.
He's just as dirty. He may not be as morally bad, like, because we don't mind when bad people get killed. He's a good do-gooder. But, yes, he is breaking all kinds of rules here by gunning down an unarmed person and saying, all right, let's make him the fall guy.
And then we get a picnic with David and his daughter at his dead wife's grave, because we were told that the Day of the Dead is a time for picnics in a graveyard because you're visiting with your dead loved ones.
See, I didn't think it was David's relative. You know, it's mysterious, yeah, who the mother of his daughter is. They just don't even, again, wouldn't that be something you'd want to have an urban legend phantom kill her or something to make this daughter afraid, Candyman or somebody else? Missed opportunity. I think that's the grave of the mom. I actually think that it is Caroline's mother, Annie's grave, and they're just along because, you know, he wants to get dessert afterwards.
Oh, I took it as David's dead wife's grave.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, that's how I took it too, but you know what? Who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
And who cares, more importantly?
Yeah, fill in the blank, whatever you want it to be. Certainly not the makers of this movie have any idea what they're doing.
So Jacob, Stewart, does this movie give a whole new meaning to PMS? Jacob.
Look, I'm actually not going to ding this film because it breaks continuity and all that. I'm not going to justify it like Stuart saying, oh, it's urban myth and it changes. It just, look, I remember when I walked into a Hollywood Video circa 2000. I saw that Leprechaun in the Hood VHS cassette, saw its goofy little tagline. I'm like, yep, I'm going to watch that. And so I get it. This is just a stupid movie to throw on the shelves that someone, they're going to see, oh, I remember a Candyman movie. I like that. Let's get this. And they're not going to remember all the mythology and all that. So the fact that this doesn't quite jive and it repeats a lot of the same stuff of those first two, okay, whatever. Like, there's much greater sins to ding against this. Like, it's got a lead actress that is awful. It's really kind of a nonsensical storyline. And really, what it comes down to, you know, sweets for the sweet. At first, I'm like, is this a razor blade in my little fun-size Snickers that I got trick-or-treating? No, that's giving it too much credit. It's not, like, that gory or horrifying. Is this a Almond Joy when I just wanted a Mounds because I don't like the nuts? And what? This movie is nuts, but I like that coconut too.
That is nuts. It's always Almond Joy, sir.
No, it's always Mounds.
Never.
For another podcast.
Mounds.
Thank you. What I really came down on, remember when you get wax teeth, you go trick-or-treating, you get those wax teeth, and you're like, oh, these look cool, and you stick them in your mouth, and it just tastes awful, and it turns to mud when you chew on it, like, that's what this is. This is wax teeth, flavorless. Just why would you even make this? Serves no purpose. Can you tell it's a not recommend? Because it's a strong one.
Stuart.
Yeah, wax teeth, that's a good one. I like that. But yeah, not much of a legend. We can all agree at this point that this is not a tale that you tell to frighten children or anyone or perpetuate any kind of franchise. It is the script you give Doug Bradley because he's shelling this stuff into the deader crowd in Hellraiser 6. And it was only going to work if you believed in Tony Todd. I like Tony Todd. I feel like this entire series has not used him to full effect. And in a part 3, we're ready for it to be given completely to the villain. We don't need a hero anymore. The idea that a Baywatch babe is supposed to hold our interest, marketing paintings at that, like, it's just, come on. Tony Todd waving his chocolate bar at a set of goofy dead meat characters and telling punny jokes. It may not be nutritious, but it's edible. That's what we want to eat when we sit down to watch a Candyman 3. And the only good news I can see is, they knew what they made, right? They stopped. Everyone could see this movie sucked, and no one was going to say Candyman a fourth time. Last week we said farewell to the flesh. This week we throw the whole bathwater and baby out. The skeleton of the story goes too, and what we're left with is the memory of a pretty good film that has been reduced to ash.
So that's a not recommend?
Pretty much.
I have to disagree with you, because you keep bringing up those later Hellraiser sequels, and that is the bar by which I was really going to measure this.
Okay, good.
And this is so much more true to the spirit of Candyman than any of those were to the spirit of Hellraiser, because all of those took some moldy psychodrama script.
I mean, this is better than that Hellraiser that took place in someone's house after a trip to Tijuana.
Yeah?
Not that one, but yeah, you're telling me that you, like, the part fives, those straight-the-tape storylines, you find this to be more entertaining.
I find this to be more true to Candyman, because the Hellraiser story was at the beginning, somebody opens a box, Cenobites or Frank or somebody shows up, and then you spend the rest of the movie trying to get them back in the box until you get to that direct-to-video shit where the box was never even supposedly open and Pinhead's not going to show up till the last 5 minutes. This here is a direct emulation of the first two films. In that way, it is trying to stay more to the franchise than any direct-to-video Hellraiser film did.
But that's not what I asked. Again, like, who cares about continuity?
I'm not saying continuity. I'm saying...
You are! You're saying that this follows more of a pattern of what the first two Candymans did, but is it any more fun than a Hellraiser 7?
Yeah, but that's not continuity. Continuity, I don't give a shit about it being the year 2024. I just think this feels like a Candyman movie.
A bad one. A one you would not want to watch. It is one you wouldn't want to rent.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a bad Candyman film. I'm just saying it's better than those Hellraiser pieces of shit. I'm definitely ready to give Candyman the hook, yank him off the stage, and give this a not recommend. But it's just not as atrocious as I expected it to be coming in, is what I can say. It's just bad.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I guess that's common ground. It is not the worst horror movie I've ever seen, but just thoroughly unentertaining. I mean, we can all agree there's nothing here to recommend. There's no part of this fast forward and get to this part. Start to finish, it's goose eggs.
Unless Honeycomb is your kink.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe it is a thing for you. It might work as a Playboy Playmate video, except Donna doesn't even want to put out.
Except you don't get to see the Playmate naked. It's the other ones.
Yeah, that's so strange. I don't get it. So do we know why there wasn't a Candyman 4? It seems to me like it's not awful enough that they couldn't have scrounged together some even worse part 4.
I mean, they did make two more Wishmasters after Wishmaster 2, which came out around this time.
Is it because Tony Todd started doing the Final Destination film, so he didn't have to have Candyman?
Maybe.
That could be part of it.
I mean, he's in those films as much as he's in these ones, which is shocking.
Nobody really wanted to do this one but Tony. Tony got everybody on board. They were like, all right, let's give it a shot. And it didn't work. So I just think nobody wanted to come back because it was viewed as rotten fruit. The only way to do this would be a reboot. But who would want to reboot it? Because it does seem kind of still second tier. You know, Freddy and Jason and Michael are your A-listers. And you got, like, the Cenobites and Chucky and things on your B-list. Candyman's definitely a C-lister.
I guess if you look at it in terms of some kind of slasher pantheon, sure. But Candyman, the first movie, is better than any Friday the 13th movie. Like, you had something more there than you usually do when you start out on a horror franchise. And they just pissed it all away.
But Jordan Peele is producing. He's not directing. I mean, it's not going to be exactly the same minds that brought us Get Out and Us. But hopefully soon we will see the new vision of Candyman. That is it a sequel? Is it a continuation? Is Tony Todd involved? A lot of rumors.
I did go back and watch the trailer. At least we're going back to Cabrini Green.
Yeah, and the spoiler that I've read is the baby from the first movie is the main character.
Anthony.
Yeah, Anthony is all grown up, and he's that guy that we see in the trailer as the star.
Yeah, there's no Tony Todd in that trailer, no Tony Todd name showing up in that trailer. So I guess I could go to IMDb and find out, but I don't want to spoil it.
I think they're holding back. I bet you Tony's going to be there, maybe with the help of special effects, too. Like, they might do something to make him look different. But I think it's going to be a direct sequel to the first movie only. I think you can and maybe should ignore 2 and 3.
Definitely ignore them.
I'd be game with a complete reboot myself. And yeah, I didn't get much from that trailer that it would or wouldn't be a continuation. But I did mention Vanessa Williams is coming back for it, so...
But not that Vanessa Williams.
You saved the best for last.
Well, she was Anthony's mom, so that kind of makes sense. So I have a little bit more hope. I do not know the director, Nia DaCosta.
She's got one film out, Little Woods, which I plan on watching before whenever this reboot comes out.
Yeah, it streams on Hulu. So yeah, same thought. I will like to see what got her this gig. And yeah, hopefully that there's passion for the original movie that they could, again, I think you could make a better movie than even the first one. I think Jordan Peele has real major talent. And, you know, depending on how much he wants to put his fingerprints on it, this could be a great film.
Well, I want to thank our great listeners for their patience. You know, it took us a little longer to get to Candyman than we expected, and it's still going to be a little bit longer before we get to that reboot. Whenever that comes out, though, you will be getting that review. We promised it to all silver and higher donors, so thank you for your support, and we look forward to reviewing that for you. And if you're a platinum or higher level donor, you've still got 5 more weeks of movies reviews coming.
Slasher movies at that. Sleepaway Camp. You know, it is, you know, with COVID and all that, is one of the casualties has been the camp experience that so many of us at summer like to have. Well, I think it's kind of fun that we're going to go back to, it's not exactly Crystal Lake, but that kind of environment, and see what another kind of slasher can do.
I can't wait to hear you guys talk about what happens at the waterfront after the social.
Yeah. In the meantime, happy birthday, everyone. Now Playing is celebrating its 1,000th show this Tuesday with a big surprise mystery podcast. We're not even announcing what the movie is, but we're doing something special for you guys on Tuesday.
1,000 reviews, not even 1,000 episodes. Like, I'm taking away all of the books and nachos.
We're not double dipping with Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah, we did 2 reviews, so that counts twice. But taking away all the Twin Peaks episodes, taking away all of the interview episodes, not counting the Langen Camp, Robert Englund interviews and things like that. Just movie reviews, 1,000 of them.
And what's our 1,001? It's going to be Real Genius next Friday. I love that. Of course it's got to be. How can we top our 1,000th show? Real Genius! Finally!
Yes, many were guessing that Real Genius would be the 1,000th show.
It is not. It is not.
It is 1,001.
Yes.
It's got to be Soul Man then, right? Oh, I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, let's not give away any more secrets. But it should be fun. I hope to see you there on Tuesday and in the weeks ahead.
Yes, it is you guys who made it possible for us to do 1,000 shows. You know, all listeners, we love and we appreciate the downloads, but you guys who actually give your hard-earned money to us so that we can keep doing this.
Especially during this time when people are really struggling, it means a lot that maybe this is important diversion for you. So thank you for that.
Indeed. Thank you so much. It's true. Without you, the donors, we would not make 1,000 episodes, and so happy we are. But we do it for you, our listeners. It was always for you.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Sweet to the sweet.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
I have a curriculum I have to follow here.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I can't say nothing, or Candyman will get me.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Hands up, people! 5-0, come out the back door! Police!
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Why do you want to live? If you would learn just a little from me, you would not beg to live.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of, and may not be used without the expressed written permission of, Venganza Media Incorporated.
What do the good know, except what the bad teach them by their excesses?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Our names will be written on 1,000 walls, our crimes told and retold by our faithful believers. We shall die together in front of their very eyes and give them something to be haunted by. Come with me and be immortal.
There's no commentary. Nobody did jack or shit for this. I dug up a 1999 issue of Fangoria magazine I happen to have.
Okay, well, thanks for digging deep.
Marjorie was so pissed, but I ordered like an entire back run of Fango. And she's like, what the fuck are all these magazines coming through the mail?
Did you order the Playboy too as research?
No. I mean, I did this back when we were doing Hellraiser. I'm like, I just want every issue of Fangoria now. So I had this issue lying around.